हरे
When lunch was ready, Swamiji would wash his hands and mouth in the bathroom and come out into the front room. His soft pink bottomed feet always bare, his saffron dhoti reaching down to his ankles. He would stand by the coffee table, which held the picture of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, while his own associates stood around him against the walls. Keith would bring in a big tray of chapatis, stacked by the dozens, and place it on the floor before the altar table, along with pots of rice, dal, and sabji. Swamiji would then recite the Bengali prayer for offering food to the Lord, and all present would follow him by bowing down, knees and head to the floor, and approximating the Bengali word one word at a time. While the steam and mixed aromas drifted up like an offering of incense before the picture of Lord Chaitanya, the Swamiji's followers bowed their heads to the wooden floor and mumbled the prayer. Prabhupada then sat with his friends, eating the same prasadam as they, with the addition of a banana and a metal bowl full of hot milk. He would slice the banana by pushing it downward against the edge of the bowl, letting the slices fall into the hot milk. Prabhupada's open decree that everyone should eat as much prasadam as possible created a humorous mood and a family feeling. No one was allowed simply to sit, picking at his food, nibbling politely. They ate with a gusto Swami almost insisted upon. Like gusto means, you know, great enthusiasm, right? Like that. Well, you guys wouldn't know anything about this, right? You just sit and pick. Oh, that's only the VIP, sorry. Okay. If he saw someone not eating heartily, he would call the person's name and smilingly protest, "Why are you not eating? Take prasadam," and he would laugh. "When I was coming to your country on the boat," he said, "I thought, how will the Americans ever eat this food?" And as the boys pushed their plates forward for more, Keith would serve seconds, more rice, dal, chapatis, and sabji. After all, it was spiritual. You were supposed to eat a lot. It would purify you. It would free you from maya. Beside, it was good, delicious, spicy. This was better than American food. It was like chanting. It was far out. You got high from eating this food. They ate with the right hand, Indian style. Keith and Howard had already learned this and had even tasted similar dishes. But as they told the Swami in a room full of believers, the food in India had never been this good. One boy, Stanley, was quite young, and Prabhupada, almost like a doting father, watched over him as he ate. Stanley's mother had personally met Prabhupada and said that only if he took personal care of her son would she allow him to live in the monastery. Prabhupada complied. He diligently encouraged the boy until Stanley gradually took on a voracious appetite and began consuming 10 chapatis at a sitting, and would have taken more had Swamiji not told him to stop. But aside from Swamiji's limiting Stanley to 10 chapatis, the word was always more, take more. When Prabhupada was finished, he would rise and leave the room. Keith would catch a couple of volunteers to help him clean, and the others would leave. Occasionally on a Sunday, Prabhupada himself would cook a feast with special Indian dishes. Steve. Swamiji personally cooked the prasadam and then served it to us upstairs in his front room. We all sat in rows, and I remember him walking up and down in between the rows of boys, passing before us with his bare feet, serving us with a spoon from different pots. He would ask, what did we want? Did we want more of this? And he would serve us with pleasure. These dishes were not ordinary, but sweets and savories, like sweet rice and kachoris with special tastes. Even after we had all taken a full plate, he would come back and ask us to take more. Once he came up to me and asked what I would like more of. Would I like some more sweet rice? In my early misconception of spiritual life, I thought I should deny myself what I like best. So I asked some more plain rice. But even that plain rice was fancy yellow rice with fried cheese balls. So you see, Prabhupada's, means this is the thing, is if you can cook, then it's so important, just in general, in preaching and in, friends, family, everything's, because everybody likes to eat nice. And so we see so much enthusiasm is generated here. Everybody's eating very nicely. And by taking prasadam, one is purified, right? So here, this whole thing of being able to cook, being able to serve prasad, knowing, how to eat and being inspired also to eat, how to clean, all these different things then make it very, very, inspiring, and it's very attractive. So you can see how much is here. So there's not much facilities, this and that, but we see Prabhupada's cooking, rice, dal, sabzi, chapatis, cooking kachoris, cooking fancy rice, all kinds of things that he was doing, right? Does this make sense? Right? So that's why so much emphasis is put on the cooking, because if you know that nicely, then in any sphere you go, it's successful, because everybody likes to eat, right? Is there anyone you know who doesn't like to eat? No, everyone likes to eat, right? You don't like to eat. Okay, so that's one guy who doesn't like to eat. Right?
What? Bob said maybe health freaks don't like to eat.
Health freaks don't like to eat. That's because they don't like to be healthy. Right? The thing is the taste is freaking out about health, not being healthy. Right? That's it. They like to eat. They just like to eat things that don't taste good. Right? If it doesn't taste good, it's supposed to be healthier. Right? Yes? No? Something? No. You warm enough? Okay. You?
Yes.
You? Hmm? Hello, you warm enough? You're warm enough? Okay. On off nights, his apartment was quiet. He might remain alone for the whole evening, typing and translating Srimad Bhagavatam, or talking in a relaxed atmosphere to just one or two guests until 10. But on meeting nights, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, there was activity in every room of his apartment. He wasn't alone anymore. His new followers were helping him, and they shared in the spirit of trying to get people to chant Hare Krishna and hear of Krishna consciousness. In the back room, he worked on his translation of the Bhagavatam, or spoke with guests up until 6. Then he would go to take his bath. Sometimes he would have to wait until the bathroom was free. He had introduced his young followers to the practice of taking 2 baths a day, and now he was sometimes inconvenienced by having to share his bathroom. After his bath, he would come into the front room, where his assembled followers would sit around him. He would sit on a mat facing his picture of the Panchatattva, and after putting a few drops of water in his left palm from a small metal wooden from a small metal spoon and bowl, he would rub a lump of Vrindavan clay in the water, making a wet paste. He would then apply the clay markings of Vaishnav Tilak, dipping into the yellowish paste in his left hand with his ring finger of his right hand. He would scrape wet clay from his palm, and while looking into a small mirror, which he held deftly between the thumb and pinky of his left hand, he would mark a vertical clay strip up his forehead, and then trim the clay into two parallel lines, by placing the little finger of his right hand between his eyebrows, and running it upward past the hairline, clearing the path in the still moist clay. Then he marked 11 other places on his body, while the boys sat observing, sometimes asking questions, or sometimes speaking their own understandings of Krishna consciousness. Mm. Understand ring finger? Yeah? Ring finger? No? Ring finger. Yes? No? Yes, which is the ring finger? That one. Okay. You? Right, so you have your thumb, right? Right? Then you have your index finger. Right? Then you have the middle finger. Right? Then there's ring finger and then little finger. Right? Okay? Makes sense? So this is right hand, right? Then same on left hand. Except it's opposite. See, it starts, the thumb starts on this side on this hand, but it starts on this side on this hand. Right? If it's not like that, let me know. Okay. And if you have kind of like the thumb like this on your foot, also I want to know about it. Yes.
How is the sixth one then called?
The sixth finger.
Like some people that have the sixth one and it's considered to be, I don't know.
I guess it depends where it is.
But there is no like a specific name for it.
I've never heard that other than, no, I haven't heard like that. Because it's not that common that people would, you know, generate terms for it. You know? Prabhupada, my Guru Maharaj used to put on tilak without a mirror. Devotee, did it come out neat? Prabhupada, neat or not neat, that does not matter. Yes, it was also neat. Prabhupada would then silently recite the Gayatri Mantra, holding his Brahman thread, his Brahman sacred thread, and looping it around his right thumb. He would sit erect, silently moving his lips. His bare shoulders and arms were quite thin, as was his chest, but he had a round, slightly protruding belly. His complexion was as satiny smooth as a young boy's, except for his face, which bore signs of age. The movements of his hands were methodical, aristocratic, yet delicate. He picked up two brass bells in his left hand and began ringing them. Then lighting two sticks of incense from the candle near the picture of Lord Chaitanya and his associates, he began waving the incense slowly in small circles before Lord Chaitanya, while still ringing the bells. He looked deeply at the picture and continued cutting spirals of fragrant smoke, all the while ringing the bells. None of the boys knew what he was doing, although he did it every evening. But it was a ceremony. It meant something. The boys began to call the ceremony bells. After bells, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, it would usually be time for the evening kirtan. Some of the devotees would already be downstairs greeting guests and explaining about the Swami and the chanting. But without the Swami, nothing could begin. No one knew how to sing or drum, and no one dared think of leading the mantra chanting without him. Only when he entered at 7 o'clock could they begin. Freshly showered and dressed in his clean Indian hand-woven cloth, his arms and body decorated with the arrow-like Vaishnav markings, Prabhupada would leave his apartment and go downstairs to face another ecstatic opportunity to glorify Krishna. The tiny temple would be crowded with wild, unbrahminical, candid young Americans. You know, so you know, the Pancharatrik, you know, standards and all that, then he would follow. So he would talk to guests in the afternoon after lunch, Then he would, at 6 o'clock, take his bath. Then after bath, put tilak, you know, Gayatri, then offer artik. And then after that, then he would go down for the class. Right? So then he'd do, so everybody could see. So then, like this, then they all pick up and wonder what's going on and start to practice. Dawn was a test of Swamiji's tolerance. He had lived in the storefront for months, working little and not trying to change his habits. He had a remarkable speak affectation. Instead of talking, he enunciated his words as if he were reciting them from a book. And he never used contractions. It wasn't that he was intellectual, just as somehow he had developed a plan to abolish his natural dialect. Don's speech struck people as bizarre, like it might be the result of too many drugs. It gave him the air of being not an ordinary being. And he continually took marijuana, even after Swamiji had asked those who lived with him not to. Sometimes during the day, his girlfriend would join him in the storefront, and they would sit together, talking intimately and sometimes kissing. But he liked the Swami. He even gave some money once. He liked living in the storefront, and Swamiji didn't complain. But others did. One day, an interesting newcomer dropped by the storefront and found Don alone, surrounded by the sharp aroma of marijuana. You been smoking pot? But the Swami doesn't want anyone smoking here. Don denied it. I have not been smoking. You are not speaking the truth. Boy then reached in Don's shirt pocket and pulled out a joint. And Don hit him in the face. Several of the boys found out. They weren't sure what was right. What would the Swami do? What do you do if someone smokes pot? Even though a devotee was not supposed to, could it be allowed sometimes? They put the matter before Swamiji. Swamiji took it very seriously, and he was upset, especially about the violence. He hit you? He asked the boy. I will go down myself and kick him in the head. But then Prabha thought about it and said that Don should be asked to leave. But Don had already left. The next morning during Swamiji's class, Don appeared at the store at the front door. From his dais, Prabha looked out at Don with great concern. But his first concern was for ISKCON. Ask him, Prabha requested Roy, who sat nearby. If he has marijuana, then he cannot come in. Our society, Prabhupada was like an anxious father, afraid for the life of his infant ISKCON. Roy went to the door and told Don he would have to give up his drugs if he entered, and Don walked away. This was this also is mentioned by Umapani Maharaj. That Prabhupada, you know, it's like if somebody's trying and progressing and all that, because this is early stages, then that would be there. But Prabhupada would not adjust the standard, even if it meant somebody would go away. Right? So he would, like, Umapati, you know, beginning with saying so many things, he had doubts about this or that, and, you know, things that would be more modern and more politically correct and all that. And Prabhupada wouldn't adjust them, even if it meant he would go away. You know, so he was impressed by that. The Prabhupada wouldn't adjust, you know, just to, you know, be popular or get more people to come or anything like that. Because the idea is that you want to be able to expose as many people to Krishna consciousness. But at the same time, there's a standard, because if they don't follow a standard, then how Krishna conscious will they become? Right? So in the beginning, if someone's just starting up, they're in their own facilities, in their own, you know, they live outside, then whatever it is, they do whatever they can. But as they want to, they take part, then they should, the standard should come up. Does that make sense? Like that. Otherwise, then it'll be a disturbance. There must be the same, like, commitment and determination. If that's there, then everybody will be able to get along nicely. Yeah? Set on your ear. The acupuncture little things, acupressure things. Okay. Yes? No? like that. So we won't change our philosophy like that. It's just the way it is. You know, many will do it, and they think that, that, you know, it makes it more palatable, but then you see no one actually takes it that seriously like that. Raphael was not interested in spiritual discipline. He was a tall young man with long, straight brown hair, who, like Don, tried to stay aloof and casual towards Swamiji. Right, these are the two first ones, Don and Raphael. So it's nice they came in like that, but others are coming and getting very serious about it, but they didn't want to change. How it was just the way when they joined, they figured that it should always be like that. You know, you just come and you take part and it's nice. You know, you take prasad, but you don't really commit yourself. You don't, like, identify with it. You don't change yourself. And so they were comfortable with that. But the problem was, is everybody else is advancing. Right? And so then the problem comes is then they won't feel they fit in. When Prabhupada introduced japa and encouraged the boys to chant during the day, Raphael didn't go for it. He said he liked a good kirtan, but he wouldn't chant on beads. One time Swamiji was locked out of his apartment and the boys had to break the lock. Swamiji asked Raphael to replace it. Days went by. Raphael would sit in the storefront reading Rimbaud. He could wander around town, but he couldn't find time to fix the lock. One evening, he dropped by the Swami's apartment, opened the lockless door, and made his way to the back room, where some boys were sitting, listening to Swamiji speak informally about Krishna consciousness. Suddenly, Raphael spoke up, expressing his doubts and revealing his distracted mind. Quote, "As for me," he said, "I don't know what's happening. I don't know whether a brass band is playing or what the heck is going on." As if that means anything, right? Some of the devotees tensed. He had interrupted their devotional mood. Raphael is very candid, Swamiji replied, smiling, as if to explain his son's behavior to the others. Raphael finally fixed the lock, but one day after a lecture, he approached the Swami, stood beside the dais and spoke up, exasperated, impatient. "I am not meant to sit in a temple and chant on beads. My father was a boxer. I am meant to run on the beach and breathe in big breaths of air." Raphael went on, gesticulating and voicing his familiar complaints, things he would rather do than take up Krishna consciousness. Suddenly, Prabhupada interrupted him in a loud voice, "Then do it, do it." Raphael shrank away, but he stayed. Right? You know, he says, "You know, I meant to do this, I meant to do that, so then do it." The point is you should be doing something and focused on something. You know, to do nothing, that's not very useful. So one should be doing something. Right? So if he doesn't want to be in the temple, he wants to run on the beach and breathe in big breaths of air, then he should go do that. You know? But, you know, when you pull them up on it and say, "So do it," then they're all, "Oh, okay." This guy, so. You always get like that. Bill Epstein took pride in his relationship with the Swami. It was honest. Although he helped the Swami by telling people about him and sending them up to see him in his apartment, he felt the Swami knew he'd never become a serious follower. Nor did Bill ever mislead himself into thinking he would ever be serious. But Prabhupada wasn't content with Bill's take-it-or-leave-it attitude. After some days at a friend's place, only to fall asleep with a blanket wrapped over his head during the... After spending some days at a friend's place, only to fall asleep with a blanket wrapped over his head during the lecture, Prabhupada would just start shouting so loud, Prabhupada couldn't sleep. I mean, Bill couldn't sleep. Sometimes Bill would ask a challenging question, and Prabhupada would answer and then say, "Are you satisfied?" And Bill would look up dreamily and answer, "No." Then Prabhupada would answer it again more fully and say louder, "Are you satisfied?" And again, Bill would say, "No." This would go on until Bill would give in. "Yes, yes, I am satisfied." But Bill was the first person to get up and dance during a kirtan in the storefront. Some of the other boys thought he looked like he was dancing in an egotistical, narcissistic way, even though his arms were outstretched in the facsimile of pictures of Lord Chaitanya. But when Swamiji saw Bill dancing like that, he looked at Bill with wide open eyes and feelingly expressed appreciation. Bill is dancing just like Lord Chaitanya. Bill sometimes returned from his wanderings with money, and although it was not very much, he would give it to the Swami. He liked to sleep at the storefront and spend the day on the street, returning for lunch or kirtans or a place to sleep. He used to leave in the morning and go looking for cigarettes on the ground. To Bill, the Swami was part of the hip movement and had thus earned a place of respect in his eyes as a genuine person. Bill objected when the boys introduced signs of reverential worship towards the Swami, starting with their giving him an elevated seat in the temple. And as the boys who lived with the Swami gradually began to show enthusiasm, competition, and even rivalry amongst themselves, Bill turned from it in disgust. He allowed that he would go on just helping the Swami in his own way, and he knew that the Swami appreciated whatever he did, so he wanted to leave it at that. Right? So we see here that other group who's a little bit more serious than, as others become more serious than that, then they don't want to move forward, right? So it's always an important thing is that you try to create an environment where the maximum amount of people can be involved, but at the same time, you also show or set a standard what is to be done, how to move forward, right? So those who can move forward are inspired will. Right? And then the others, you try to make them comfortable. Like here, he's comfortable with Prabhupada, but he's not comfortable that others are taking it more seriously when he isn't interested to take it more seriously. Carl Jurgens had helped Prabhupada in times of need. He had helped with the legal work of incorporating ISKCON, signed the ISKCON charter as a trustee, and even opened his home to Swamiji when David had driven him from the Bowery loft. But those days when he and Ava had shared their apartment with him had created a tension that had never left. He liked the Swami. He respected him as a genuine sannyasi from India, but he didn't accept the conclusions of the philosophy. The talk about Krishna and the soul was fine, but the idea of giving up drugs and sex was carrying it a little too far. Now Prabhupada was settling in his new place, and Carl decided that he had done his part to help and was no longer needed. Although he had helped Prabhupada incorporate his International Society for Krishna Consciousness, he didn't want to join it. Carl found the Second Avenue kirtans too public, not like the more intimate atmosphere he had enjoyed with the Swami on the Bowery. Now the audiences were larger, and there was an element of wild letting loose that they had never had on the Bowery. Because before is that they were all musicians and artists and that. So, they were more intellectual, more refined, and, would be much more careful of how they would behave and act. So they might do whatever they like to do, but it wouldn't be wild and all that. Well, now it's the place is open, more people are coming. It's a broader range of people. So it's not just these intellectuals and musicians. So it's just anybody. So then they're being a little bit more crazy. So someone like him wouldn't find it to be very pleasant. Like some of the other old associates, Carl felt sheepish and reluctant to join in. In comparison to the Second Avenue street scene, the old meetings at the fourth floor Bowery loft had seemed more mystical, like secluded meditations. Carol Becker also preferred a more sedate kirtan. She thought people were trying to take out their personal frustrations by the wild singing and dancing. The few times she did attend evening kirtans at Second Avenue were tense moments. One time a group of teenagers had come into the storefront mocking and shouting, "Hey, what the hell is this?" She kept thinking that at any moment a rock was going to come crashing through the big window, And anyway, her boyfriend wasn't interested. James Green felt embarrassed. He saw that most of the new men were making a serious commitment to the Swami, whereas he could not. He had no bad feeling towards the Swami and his new movement, but he preferred to live alone. Right? So you had these intellectuals, so it was just part of the scene. You know, you go down there, you know, some music and this and that. And so, you know, it was nice, but it was part of just an experience in their mind. You know, another experience, something to add, like this. So then you had a problem is that they're more refined, but not so serious. So then they would be disturbed by those who were more less refined, but also by those who were more serious. Right? Does that make sense? So there were those who were more serious, behaved better, but then because the door is open, then anybody would come and they'd do all kinds of crazy stuff. He had no bad feeling towards the Swami and his new movement, but he preferred to live alone. Robert Nelson, Prabhupada's old uptown friend, never deviated in his good feelings for Prabhupada, but he always went along in his own natural way and never adopted any serious disciplines. Somehow, almost all of those who had helped Prabhupada uptown and on the Bowery did not want to go further once he began a spiritual organization, which happened almost immediately after he moved into 26 Second Avenue. New people were coming forward to assist him, and Carl's, James, Carol, and others like them felt that they were being replaced and that their obligation towards the Swami was ending. It was a kind of changing of the guard. Although the members of the old guard were still his well-wishers, they began to drift away. Bruce Sharaf. Had just graduated from New York University and was applying for a job. One day, an ex-roommate told him about the Swami he had visited down on Second Avenue. They sing there, his friend said, and they have this far-out thing where they have some dancing, and Allen Ginsberg is there. The Swami was difficult to understand, his friend explained, and besides that, his followers recorded his talks on a tape recorder. Why should he have a big tape recorder? That's not very spiritual. But Bruce became interested, right? Because they have their own idea of what's spiritual, you know, having nothing and this and that, and so that's spiritual. Rather than it's connected to Krishna, that's spiritual, right? He was already a devotee of Indian culture. 4 years ago, when he was barely 20, Bruce had worked during the summer as a steward aboard an American freighter and gone to India, where he had visited temples, bought pictures of Shiva and Ganesh, and books on Gandhi, and felt as if he were part of the culture. When he returned to NYU, he read more about India and wrote a paper on Gandhi for his history course. He would eat in Indian restaurants and attend Indian films and musical recitals, and he was reading the Bhagavad Gita. He had even given up eating meat. He had plans of returning to India, taking some advanced college courses, and then coming back to America to teach Eastern religion. But in the meantime, he was experimenting with LSD. Chuck Barnett was 18 years old. Is that the same Chuck as before? This is a different Chuck. Can't remember. Chuck Barnett was 18 years old. His divorcee mother had recently moved to Greenwich Village, where he was studying psychology at NYU. Chuck had moved out of his mother's apartment to one on 12th Street on the Lower East Side, in the neighborhood of Allen Ginsberg and other hip poets and musicians. He was a progressive jazz flautist, who worked with several professional groups in the city. He had been practicing Hatha Yoga for 6 years and had recently been experimenting with LSD. He would have visions of lotuses and concentric circles, but after coming down, he would become more involved than ever in sensuality. lotuses and concentric circles. Okay, very nice. Very spiritual. A close friend of Chuck's had suddenly gone homosexual that summer, leaving Chuck disgusted and cynical. Somehow, someone told Chuck that an Indian Swami was staying downtown on 2nd Avenue. And so he came one day in August to the window of the former Matchless Gift store. Steve Garino, the son of a New York fireman, had grown up in the city and graduated from Brooklyn College in 1961. Influenced by his father, he had gone into the Navy, where he had tolerated 2 years of military routine, always waiting for the day he would be free to join his friends on the Lower East Side. Finally, a few months after the death of President Kennedy, he had been honorably discharged. Without so much as paying a visit to his parents, he had headed straight for the Lower East Side, which by then appeared vividly within his mind to be the most mystical place in the world. He was writing stories and short novels under the literary influence of Franz Kafka and others, and began to take LSD, quote, to search and experiment with consciousness, end quote. A Love Supreme, recorded by John Coltrane, the jazz musician, encouraged Steve to think that God actually existed. Just to make enough money to live, Steve had taken a job with the welfare office. One afternoon during his lunch hour, while walking down 2nd Avenue, he saw that the Matchless Gift store had a small piece of paper in the window announcing lectures in Bhagavad Gita, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. And I think it is the same people. I think it's just he's giving more detail. But now he's targeting certain ones. You know, who I said? Bruce, Chuck, Steve. Yeah. Chuck, I finally found 2nd Avenue and 1st Street, and I saw through the window that there was some chanting going on inside, and some people were sitting up against the wall. Beside me on the sidewalk, some middle-class people were looking in and giggling. I turned to them, and with my palms folded, I asked, "Is this where a Swami is?" They giggled and said, "Pilgrim, your search has ended." I was surprised by this answer because I felt it was the truth. Bruce and Chuck, unknown to one another, lived only 2 blocks apart. After the suggestion from his friend, Bruce also made his way to the storefront. "Bruce, I was looking for Hare Krishna. I had left my apartment and had walked over to Avenue B when I decided to walk all the way down to Houston Street. Then I came to 1st Street. I turned right, and then walking along 1st Street, I came to 2nd Avenue. All along 1st Street, I was seeing these Puerto Rican grocery stores, and then there was one of those churches where everyone was standing up, singing loudly and playing tambourines. Then as I walked further along 1st Street, I had the feeling I was leaving the world, like when you're going to the airport to catch a plane. I thought, now I am leaving a part of me behind, and I'm going to somewhere, something new. But when I got over to 2nd Avenue, I couldn't find Hare Krishna. There was a gas station, and then I walked past a little storefront, but the only sign was one that said Matchless Gifts. Then I walked back again past the store, and in the window I saw a black and white sign announcing a Bhagavad Gita lecture. I entered the storefront and saw a pile of shoes there. So I took off my shoes and came in and sat down near the back. Steve, I had a feeling that this was a group that was already established and had been meeting for a while. I came in and sat down on the floor, and a boy who said his name was Roy was very courteous and friendly to me. He seemed to be one who had already experienced the meetings. He asked me my name, and I felt at ease. Suddenly, the Swami entered through the side door, He was wearing a saffron dhoti, but no shirt, just a piece of cloth like a long sash, tied in a knot across his right shoulder, and leaving his arms, his left shoulder, and part of his chest bare. When I saw him, I thought of the Buddha. Bruce. There were about 15 people sitting on the floor. One man with a big beard sat up by the front on the right-hand side, leaning up against the wall. It must be Howard. After some time, the door on the opposite side opened, and in walked the Swami. When he came in, he turned his head to see who was in the audience. Then he stared right at me. Our eyes met. It was as if he were studying me. In my mind, it was like a photograph was being taken of Swamiji looking at me for the first time. There was a pause. Then he very gracefully got up on the dais and sat down and took out a pair of hand cymbals and began a kirtan. The kirtan was the thing that most affected me. It was the best music I'd ever heard, and it had meaning. You could actually concentrate on it, and it gave you some joy to repeat the words Hare Krishna. I immediately accepted it as a spiritual practice. Chuck. I entered the storefront, and sitting on a grass mat, must be they were all there at the same time. Chuck. I entered the storefront, and sitting on a grass mat on the hard floor was a person who seemed at first to be neither male nor female. But when he looked at me, I couldn't even look him straight in the eyes. They were so brilliant and glistening. Well, this must be earlier. His skin was golden with rosy cheeks, and he had large ears that framed his face. He had three strands of beads, one which was at his neck, one a little longer, and the other one down on his chest. He had a long forehead, which rose above his shining eyes, and there were many furrows in his brow. His arms were slender and long. His mouth was rich and full, and very dark and red and smiling. And his teeth were brighter than his eyes. He sat in a cross-legged position that I had never seen before in any yoga book, and had never seen any yogi perform. It was a sitting posture, but his right foot crossed over the thigh and brought back against his left hip. And one knee rested on the other directly in front of him. Okay, that's the Gomuk, I think he must be sitting, because he said one knee was on top of the other. So that's Gomuk. His every expression and gesture was different from those of any other personality I had ever seen. And I sensed that they had meanings that I did not know, from a culture and a mood that were completely beyond this world. There was a mole on his right, on his side, and a particular callus on his ankle, a round callus similar to what a karate expert develops on his knuckle. You know, from sitting on the floor, you get the callus on your ankle. He was dressed in unhemmed cloth, dyed saffron. Everything about him was exotic, and his whole effulgence made him seem to not even be sitting in the room, but projecting from some other place. He was so brilliant in color that it was like a Technicolor movie, and yet he was right there. I heard him speaking. He was sitting right there before me, yet it seemed as if I reached out to that if I reached out to touch him, he wouldn't be there. At the same time, seeing him was not an abstract or subtle experience, but a most intense presence. So he had all these contradictory, you know, feelings, like he's there, not there, it's the most intense, but at the same time, it's very mystical. All these different things. After the first visit to the storefront, Chuck, Steve, and Bruce each got an opportunity to see the Swami upstairs in his apartment. Steve, I was on my lunch hour and had to be back in the office very soon. I was dressed in a summer business suit. I had planned it so that I had just enough time to go to the storefront and buy some books, then go to lunch and return to work. At the storefront, one of the Swami's followers said I could go up and see the Swami. I went upstairs to his apartment and found him at his sitting place with a few boys. I must have interrupted what he was saying, but I asked him if I could purchase the 3 volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam. One of the devotees produced the books from the closet opposite Prabhupada's seat. I handled the books. They were a very special color, not usually seen in America. A reddish natural earth, like a brick. And I asked him how much they cost. $6 each, he said. I took $20 out of my wallet and gave it to him. He seemed the only one to ask about the price of the books, or give the money to, because none of the others came forward to represent him. They were just sitting back and listening to him speak. These books are commentaries on the scriptures, I asked, trying to show that I knew something about books. Swamiji said, yes, they were his commentaries. Sitting, smiling at ease, Swami was very attractive. He seemed very strong and healthy. When he smiled, all his teeth were beautiful, and his nostrils flared aristocratically. His face was full and powerful. He was wearing an Indian cloth robe, and as he sat cross-legged, his smooth skinned legs were partially exposed. He wore no shirt. But the upper part of his body was wrapped with an Indian cloth shawl. His limbs were quite slender, but he had a protruding belly. When I saw that Swamiji was having to personally handle the sale of books, I did not want to bother him. I quickly asked him to please keep the change from my $20. I took the 3 volumes without any bag or wrapping and was standing, prepared to leave when Swamiji said, "Sit down," and gestured that I should sit opposite him like the others. He had said, "Sit down," in a different tone of voice. It was a heavy tone and indicated that now the sale of the books was completed and I should sit with the others and listen to him speak. He was offering me an important invitation to become like one of the others, who I knew spent many hours with him during the day when I was usually at my job and not able to come. I envied their leisure in being able to learn so much from him and sit and talk intimately with him. By ending the sales transaction and asking me to sit, he assumed that I was in need of listening to him, and that I had nothing better in the world to do than to stop everything else and hear him. But I was expected back at the office. I didn't want to argue, but I couldn't possibly say, "I'm sorry, I have to go." I said, definitely, I am only on my lunch hour. As I said this, I had already started to move for the door. And Swamiji responded by suddenly breaking into a wide smile and looking very charmed and very happy. He seemed to appreciate that I was a working man, a young man on the go. I had not come by simply because I was unemployed and had nowhere to go and nothing to do. Approving of my energetic demeanor, he allowed me to take my leave. Right, so, you know, he's the first one that's got a job, right? And everyone else is a bum, right? So he has a job. Okay, so end here.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Sabhaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Janitai Gaura Premanandi.